Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David Latulip. This week, more about the San Francisco Film Festival from programmer Amanda Salazar and local filmmakers Jason Susberg and Kate McLean. Director Robert Kelly shares details about the TheaterWorks Silicon Valley's production of Rags. You'll hear about a new love story mystery musical being presented at Piano Fight called The Last 5 Years. Plus, regular contributor and critic at large Peter Robinson reviews the Summer of Love experience, art, fashion, and rock and roll, which just opened at the DeYoung Museum here in San Francisco, and also updates us on the latest edition of Beach Blanket Babylon. Stay with us. That's the theme from the geektastic Disney TV series Bill Nye the Science Guy. The documentary Bill Nye Science Guy will enjoy a second screening this coming Tuesday at 9 at the Alamo Draft House as part of the 60th International San Francisco Film Festival. It's a documentary by filmmakers David Alvarado and Jason Susberg, who are also big fans of the Nye, and gives us a portrait of a guy who tries on a daily basis to make the world a better place through science, advocacy, and education, well beyond the series that brought him fame. Local filmmaker Jason Susberg joins me in studio with his wife, filmmaker Kate McLean, who is also a producer for Bill Nye, Science Guy. Her short, Gut Hack, co-directed with Mario Filoni, will also enjoy a second screening, coincidentally also next Tuesday evening at the Roxy. We'll talk about that film shortly as well. San Francisco Film Festival programmer Amanda Salazar also joins us in studio. Jason has a BA in film and digital media from UC Santa Cruz and an MFA in documentary film and video production from Stanford. Before he turned to documentary filmmaking, Susberg worked in television for the Golden State Warriors and San Francisco Giants. In addition to filmmaking, he has also amassed credits as a cinematographer and an editor. Welcome to you, Jason.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Kate McLean holds a master's degree from the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. She co-directed the short documentary The Caretaker, which premiered at the Cannes Film Festival and was featured in the New York Times OpDocs series and broadcast on POV. She also co-directed the short documentary Pot Country, also with Mario Ferloni, which screened at Hot Docs and the Mill Valley International Film Festival. Kate, welcome to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. Well, let's start with Bill Nye. I think we all have a vision of the iconic popular scientist bow tie, always a part of his persona and his style, and his incredibly informative popular science show. But his reach is grander than just the TV series. What did you learn about Bill as you got to know him, Jason?
Well, I mean, what you see is what you get with Bill. He really is a passionate science communicator. Everything is an opportunity to have a science discussion. A chair is a piece of technology, is an innovation. Flickering candle, there's all this physics involved. So it's not an act. He's not just a performer with a lab coat and a bow tie, but he's true blue. And so that was the most surprising thing, because we all know TV personalities who have performances. You know, who knows if Al Roker is really passionate about the weather, but I can tell you that Bill Nye really is who he is.
Nice. And so, with someone with such a far-reaching persona and his interests, what did you decide to focus in on with Bill?
Yeah, I mean, that was the hard part, because he is the science guy, and so science is a massive discipline. There's lots of angles we could have taken.
Lots of alternative facts, too.
Well, that's, unfortunately, facts are stubborn things, to quote our friend John McCain. But, we ended up focusing on a couple of storylines. One, evolution being taught in public schools versus creationism and climate change. Those were the big focuses because right now we're in a place where science is political. I mean, science has always been political, but it's actually become partisan. And then besides those two storylines, we also focused on space exploration because Bill is the head of the Planetary Society, and they ended up launching this device called the Solar Sail. And we followed it from development to launch, which happened in 2015.
Wow. What sort of permissions did you have to get for some of the areas you filmed in?
Oh, I mean, it was a super, you know, huge challenge. Maybe Kate can talk a little bit about this, but we were, you know, we had to fight tooth and nail to get into the Creation Museum, Ken Ham's museum, and the Ark Encounter, another Ken Ham facility. But, I think Kate has a better idea of access and permissions.
Kate McLean, what sort of hoops did you have to jump through?
Well, I think my favorite permission was actually the easiest. We actually managed to go with Bill to Greenland to an ice core drilling expedition with a group of scientists from Denmark and the U.S. And unbelievably, it was remarkably easy. We had an incredible friendly scientist, Dr. Jim White, who had mentioned that he was going on this expedition in the summer, and we sort of said, can we come? And the next thing I knew, we were on a chartered National Science Foundation flight from Albany, New York, to the middle of the Greenland ice sheet, these old planes on skis that you take from New York out to Kangerlussuaq and then onto the ice sheet.
Wow. How long of a flight is that?
It was probably about 7 hours. Uh-huh. It's a little slower, I think, on these older planes because they're heavier and they fly lower.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And I think we've all heard stories about filmmakers maxing out their credit cards to make their dream projects happen. Did that happen with this or perhaps in some of your earlier projects? And how was this funded?
Well, yeah, I mean, this we were incredibly fortunate because we had such a charismatic, wonderful subject who had a lot of goodwill and amongst millennials. And so we actually ended up raising most of the budget on Kickstarter. So we didn't personally put our credit cards on the line this time. The last feature film we did, The Immortalist, which I directed along with David and Kate produced it, that was a very scrappy production. It was about two scientists that wanted to live forever and the trials and tribulations of trying to come up with some sort of medical interventions to make us all live longer. That was a very different project. That one we definitely used our own lines of credit. This was a little bit different.
Maybe use some of the frequent flyer miles from that to get some of the trips for this.
Precisely.
Well, tell us about some of the other places you visited then with Bill.
Some of the more interesting stuff was actually just in his home. He lives in Los Angeles, and we visited his childhood home in Washington, D.C., the home of his brother. These are not exactly the more fascinating, interesting on paper, but we really wanted to show the man behind the bow tie. And so taking viewers to places that they normally wouldn't get access to was something that we really wanted to do. Besides those places, we actually ended up hanging out with him. We had a backstage pass to his life. So it was all over the place. We went to Midwest. We went to colleges across the East Coast, West Coast. So it really did take us a lot of places.
A geektastic adventure, no doubt. What was the most geekalicious thing you guys did?
Probably the launching of LightSail. I like the word geekalicious. I'm going to go ahead and copy and take that one from you.
Five cents, please.
you can have it. They gave us a backseat pass to watch this rocket launch at Cape Canaveral. It was a SpaceX, a UAL rocket. The next one is going to be SpaceX. And so we got to watch a rocket launch. It was fantastic, and we got to be in the control room as the sail deployed into space, and it was incredibly – it was not exactly something that I would normally get to see, and we were there front row.
Mm. How about you, Kate?
Greenland is still one of the most fantastic places I've ever been in my life. It was really pretty amazing to be so far away from civilization. We took snowmobiles out onto the ice sheet at one point to where you could see nothing on the horizon 360 degrees around yourself. And it's a feeling unlike anything I've ever felt before to see this expanse of nothingness and truly feel alone in the world. So there were some really special experiences that we got to have coming along with Bill on this film. And I'd like to think that the film kind of can bring viewers to some of those places with us, too. Hmm.
I understand one of the places you visited, I don't know if there were multiple places, were biblical theme parks. Mm-hmm. Was he there to disprove or dissuade or just to observe and drop his jaw?
That's a good question. And we get into the motivations of why Bill did this in the movie, but we were there, you know, sort of bearing witness to this, what Bill called a temple of ignorance. And so, you know, he was invited by the pastor. His name is Ken Ham, and he's the one who's in charge of the Creation Museum. And, I mean, it was jaw-dropper. They had their own, talk about alternative facts. They had an entirely alternative worldview that really had nothing to do with faith, and it was just anti-science. And so it was pretty, you know, spectacular.
I think, you know, what Bill objects to in the film about these institutions are these are very sort of state-of-the-art museums with, like, cool animatronic interactive exhibits, and the goal is to teach school children that the Earth is 6,000 years old and that humans existed at the same time as dinosaurs, things that, you know, the scientific record can disprove. And so it's not that he takes issue with faith or religion or Christianity in any way. It's that he wants children to be exposed to science from an early age, and he objects to institutions that look like museums, but that are going to maybe put children at an educational disadvantage.
That's the most frightening part of it. I'm just getting chills thinking about this, thinking of kids that are going to grow up thinking that, because that's what mommy and daddy told me, and that's they're not being taught anything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very scary. Mm-hmm. So with every film, one has to think of narrative arc. So what was your narrative arc for Bill Nye, Science Guy?
Yeah, so there was really two parts to it. One was like his launching of the solar sail, which was Carl Sagan's dream from 40 years previously. And so Bill sort of stepping in the, you know, the cosmic moon boots of Carl Sagan and taking on that mantle and getting the sail into outer space. That was really one of the stories that we were tracking. But also, what happened to Bill Nye? Because we started making this movie in 2014. Right after the debate, he really was kind of in obscurity, kind of languishing in Hollywood doing, I mean, I don't think he would refer to it this way, but I will, but like crappy reality televisions on Hope and Garden Network. And so we started following him as he was reemerging. And a lot of people, when we were saying we were profiling him, we had a lot of people who thought he had died because there was an internet rumor. And then now it's 2017 and he's all over the place, and we kind of got
grayer and wiser.
Exactly.
Still has the bow tie.
Exactly. So it was sort of his reemergence, I guess you could say. That was our story.
Nice. Let's move on to Gut Hacked. Kate McLean, tell us about Gut Hack.
Gut Hack is a short film that actually Amanda Salazar, who's here with us, was like the first person to believe in and support. And basically it follows a scientist who was formerly working at NASA here, who decides to kind of start doing his own experiment in his apartment. And his goal is that after kind of having a lifetime of digestive issues, he wants to try to eradicate all the microbes on and in his body and then replace them with the microbes from another person, a healthy donor, through sort of a DIY fecal transplant and also, you know, skin and cheek swabs.
I'm anticipating some interesting visuals there.
It all took place at a hotel, which will not be named, down by the San Francisco airport.
Wow.
And it was a real adventure.
That's amazing. How long is the film?
About 13 minutes.
And how much film did you shoot to make those 13 minutes?
You know, it's funny. Some people
film. I mean, now it's digital frames.
Now it's just terabytes. Now you just like measure it in terabytes. I think I've got it all on a 2 terabyte drive. But I think probably we shot the experiment itself unfolded over the course of about 5 days, and we filmed a little bit beforehand with Josiah, who's the subject of the film, and then sort of periodically checked in with him afterwards over the course of probably 6 months. You know, we would sometimes come down and film for an afternoon with Josiah.
So I imagine, you know, speaking of digital versus actual film, which I'm sure you've worked with.
Actually, I have never worked with actual film. Jason has, because at Stanford they encourage students to shoot a film on 16 millimeter color film, which is the spectacular luxury. But I have never had that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. But it must be a difference in resources that you can, as long as you've got the memory capacity in terabytes, you can shoot whatever you want. Whereas with film, you had to be very conservative about what you were using and what was going to end up on the floor, because there's a major expense going on there.
Yeah.
Do you find that a difference, Jason, in your approach to filmmaking now as well, that you can shoot the moon?
Absolutely. I think, now it's antiquated. It's not an opportunity that most people get to, shoot in celluloid. And so having that as like a foundational project early on in my film school education was really informative, because now, you don't just fire hose it. You actually have to be deliberate and make your choices.
Mm.
But even if you've never shot on film before, you learn pretty quickly that you shouldn't fire hose, because you pay the price in the edit room, particularly in documentary.
Especially
you're hundreds of hours of thoughtlessly recorded material will all haunt you make it a total nightmare to try to put your story together.
Brave new world, new technology, but nonetheless some sound film techniques and training mm-hmm. comes into play for that. Gut Check, Gut Hack will be screened. Have been up since 4:30 this morning. Will be screened on Tuesday, April 18th at 8:30 at the Roxy. It's on a program of their Shorts One program, which includes "And the Whole Sky Fit in the Dead Cow's Eye," "A Brief History of Princess X," "The Convention," "The Rabbit Hunt," "Real Artists," and "Red Apples." Some nice fellow filmmakers with you on that run.
Absolutely. Some people that we know through the Filmhouse program here, which is a program that SF Film runs for local filmmakers, where they give you office space, and it's a great community opportunity for filmmakers to know each other and support each other, and really cool to see people that I know through that program now here at the film festival.
So Kate McLean, filmmaker for Gut Hack, and as producer for Bill Nye Science Guy, do you want to run the gamut of film work? Do you anticipate writing, criticism, directing, or what's your passion for film at this point?
I love stories, and I love that documentary is this kind of scrappy opportunity to work with other people to see what a story really demands in order to be made, and to play the role that's needed in order to facilitate that story being told. So I like directing. I actually very specifically like co-directing, because I really like the process of sharing ideas with someone else. And then I also really enjoy producing. And I sort of am happy to swap in and out of those roles as needed in order to participate in stories that are exciting to me.
Jason, also delving into other areas of filmmaking?
Well, we, as our production company, we do stories about science and technology. And so I see myself just as Kate does, as a storyteller. So it's all the same to me, whether it's editing, doing graphics, directing, shooting, recording sound. It's all in the service of storytelling for science.
Let's bring Amanda Salazar into the conversation, a programmer for SF Film and the festival. Amanda, by the time the festival is over on the 19th, there will have been some 181 films screened, which included 66 narrative features, 36 documentaries, 2 TV series, 75 shorts, and over 51 countries represented. Now, how many will you have seen, either in a pre-festival screening setting or at the theaters?
I'm not just the only programmer with the festival. There are 3 other people that I get to work with and kind of share this load of picking all the films for the festival. But we collectively have seen the whole program. But I will have to say I've definitely seen about 92% of it. There are some films that I just wasn't able to catch in the theatrical setting because of certain films that we recruited out of film festivals. So sometimes, using Sundance, for example, that might have been the only screening, but 2 of my fellow programmers were in that screening, and they were then, they agreed and wanted to bring the film to the festival.
Neat. Now, what was your specific role when divvying up duties for programming? Do you say, I like the narratives, let me look at the narratives, let me look at the shorts, or is it like, here's this pile of things we need to get through, let's go?
I will have to say, I'm new to the team. I actually joined in October to SF Film, and it's been a wonderful, not only learning experience, to really be a part of this wonderful team that we actually all share a passion for any length and any genre of film. So there are definitely things that I, you know, perhaps like lean more towards. And I really have like, I love documentary film as a kind of kid already mentioned, kind of supporting her early on with her short. But then I also love all the short films and the same with our narratives. So, and I can say the same without speaking, you know, for them as much, but I definitely know that Rachel, Rod, and Audrey, my fellow programmers, also share a passion for just really great storytelling as well.
And highlights for you for the festival?
Well, there's so many, but I will say we've had a wonderful kickoff to our 60th San Francisco Film Festival, and we're going into our second week and thinking about that and some highlights that are coming up. We're really celebrating the 60th that way and embracing a lot of those anniversaries. So, for example, like tonight we're going to be celebrating Disposable Film Fest is having their 10th anniversary, and we are going to be showing some highlights from their program over the last 10 years on Saturday, Canyon Cinema is celebrating their 50th anniversary, and we're doing a special program of handpicked short films from the collection by Guy Madden. And then our 60th, I would say, kind of celebration is our closing night, which is happening on Sunday, even though our festival doesn't actually close until Wednesday.
I was going to mention that. Yeah. The closing party is premature.
We're trying something new.
Premature capitulation, shall we say.
Yes. But I will say that on that Sunday, you know, we've commissioned a very special piece that really, I think, celebrates the Bay Area filmmaking community and, you know, really what we're trying to capture with this, you know, us being 60 years old and been showcasing such great film in the city. So there's a commissioned film that Guy Madden also helped. He co-directed, but the Kronos Quartet will be doing a live score along with it as well.
Good friends of KLW, mm-hmm. as is their arranger, Jacob Garchik, who I have to give a shout, whose proud mama is the San Francisco Chronicle's Leah Garchik.
Yes.
So that'll be some live music to this specially created film, The Green Fog, a San Francisco Fantasia with the Kronos Quartet. Mm-hmm. That's going to be the closing, quote in quotes, air quotes, closing night party and screening, 8:30 this Sunday. The party's at 8:30, I believe.
Corrected, the film screening's at 7 o'clock.
At the Castro
at
Theater.
The Castro.
All this information at sffilm.org. Amanda, as well as Jason and your wife, Kate McLean, there it is. Thanks so much for coming in today, and I wish you the rest of the festival, which goes beyond, again, beyond Sunday through Wednesday. Happy screenings.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Still to come, you'll learn about a new mystery musical love story called The Last 5 Years, plus regular contributor and critic-at-large Peter Robinson reviews the Summer of Love Experience, art, fashion, and rock and roll, and offers a update on the latest edition of Beach Blanket Babylon. Stay with us. That's music from The Overture to Rags, book by Joseph Stein, music by Charles Strauss, Theater Works Silicon Valley, continuing its 2016-17 season with a musical saga of immigrant America. From the creators of Fiddler on the Roof and Wicked, this musical follows the journey of Jewish immigrants Rebecca and her son David in New York in turn-of-century tenements. The lyrics are by Stephen Schwartz, aforementioned Wicked and Pippin writer. Music by Charles Strauss, still going strong at 88. The man who brought us the musicals Annie and Bye Bye Birdie, among others. And it's directed by Robert Kelly, my guest today. Robert is a Bay Area native and Stanford grad, and the founder of TheaterWorks back in 1970 when I was 7 years old. Has been its artistic director ever since. He's directed over 165 productions at TheaterWorks, including many world and regional premieres. His accolades include the Silicon Valley Arts Council's Legacy Laureate Award, the Bay Area Theater Critics Circle Payne Knickerbocker Award for Lifetime Achievement. I don't think lifetime's over yet, Robert. You might want to send that one back.
Thank you.
The Critics Circle Awards for Outstanding Direction for 10 of his productions there. And recent directing credits include Cyrano, Peter and the Starcatcher, Sweeney Todd, Marry Me a Little, and many more. Robert, welcome to Open Air. I should say, welcome back. I'm sure we've talked before.
Thanks, David. It's a real pleasure to be on Open Air again.
Well, so often over the past several months, I've had guests on that are involved in the art scene that are bringing to the stage works that have a certain timeliness, shall we say, whether that was intentional or not when they were programming the works. Now, Robert, did you think of bringing Rags to the stage before the current Trumpocracy we're living in?
Well, we chose the play about a year and a quarter ago, right when all of the talk about immigration was really gearing up in the Republican primaries. Mm. And it seemed like a lot of talk was going on, a lot of negative talk, to be honest. This play is one I'd always wanted to repeat at TheaterWorks. We did it many, many years ago, shortly after it debuted, and this seemed like the perfect time to bring it back. Immigration seems to be not only a feature of our contemporary discussion, but a naturally vital part of the American experience.
Indeed. Now, with the results of November and subsequent things that have been happening in Washington, has the approach to the work become more profound rather than celebratory, say, if that someone else was the true winner of the White House?
I think there's some of each in this musical. It's a wonderful piece of art, and yet it is reviewing, it's exploring, and it's debating what Americans think about immigration and what they think about immigrants. And the role that immigrants have played in our culture from the beginning.
Rags did not have such a great history on Broadway, closing after just a few performances after opening in 1986, even with such luminaries in the cast as Teresa Stratus, as Rebecca Hershkovitz, Larry Kurt, the original Tony in West Side Story as Nathan. Why do you suppose that was?
Well, they had positioned the piece as a great American opera. And as you can imagine, there's a great opera star in the lead role. They spent a huge amount of money on the scenery, on a very large orchestra. It was going to be a difficult show to keep running, a cast of 30. And ultimately, they didn't have the reviews to bring it in and make it go. But on the other hand, I think maybe they missed the point that the play was about little people, not about big people, and not really about stars. It was about a shared heritage that has defined so many people in America. Mm. And when it got down to something that was about your neighbors or your own family's experience and was up close and personal, it really soared when we did it at TheaterWorks in 1989, and it has soared now. Once again.
Well, even Strauss had mentioned that the original production was a bit bloated, and he revised it in 1999, I guess, down in Florida. Is that the go-to production now, the revision from 1999? Are you picking and choosing? Are you able to pick and choose? What's the story of Rags right now,
well,
if we want to put it on?
There were various productions since the original, each one changing it in various ways. This particular version is one that was done in 2011 by Strauss and Stein. They put it together. It debuted in Texas, and this is one of the very few productions that has been authorized of this version since then. We had permission directly from Stephen Schwartz, who's worked at TheaterWorks several times and will be back in the fall.
Oh, so, fantastic.
Yeah, he's kind of a friend of the company's at this point. And in fact, there's another version of it that will be a new version of it that will be done at the Goodspeed Opera House in the fall. So, in fact, I just heard they're scheduling a reading of it in New York in just a couple of weeks. So, there's a little still more has, action on the rags front. As
still
it goes
has legs.
Along.
Well, again, you especially now have the timeliness factor going for you.
Absolutely,
and the fact that the music is from the pen of Charles Strauss, the writer of such musicals as Annie, Bye Bye Birdie, Applause, among others, as well as, I didn't realize this, Once Upon a Time, that great standard from the less familiar musical, All American. And he wrote the theme to All in the Family as well.
I think this is his finest score to be, you know, and I've certainly been exposed to many, many musicals over the years. This one combines all of the musical styles of the turn of the century into a wonderful work of art. It has klezmer and Russian music because people have escaped from Russia to come to the United States, where they kind of musically meet up with ragtime, Tin Pan Alley, and even Sousa-type music going into this piece. All of them weave together in a really magnificent score. It's one of the great CDs available of the American Musical Theater.
Well, Strauss wrote of his original cast as being on the too big a side. He was trying to do too much, he said.
Absolutely.
What's the size of your cast, and tell us about your cast.
Well, we have
and about your casting process, if you would. How did you end up with this cast?
Well, we have 15 in this cast. Originally, there were 30 on Broadway, so we needed a lot of people who could do multiple roles and play different things. Our standard casting procedure is to look locally for the very best in the Bay Area and then travel often to New York, occasionally to Los Angeles, looking for other talent to fill in where we need people. And this show has one actor out of Los Angeles. It has four from New York, and the rest are wonderful local music theater professionals. And we think we have just a tremendous, tremendous cast. The company is led by Kira Miller as Rebecca, with a young local, she's out of New York, with a young local actor named Jonah Broskow as her son. And he's just a tremendous young talent as well. Kira, her family shares a very large amount of similarities with the story that we're telling. And so do a number of people in our cast. A large number of them have family that came through Ellis Island that wound up in the tenements, that tried to find different ways of scraping out a living, and eventually created families that have led to this cast. So we had a wonderful first rehearsal, I have to say, where everyone shared their past. And we found that shared common ground is true of the audience that's coming to see the show. We've had an exceptional advance sale on this piece, even though it's a musical that is unknown to many, many people. The subject matter and the relevance of immigration as a defining principle of America, we think, has brought a lot of people in to see this wonderful production.
Mm. It's running through the 30th of April at the Mountain View Center for the Performing Arts. Theater Works, that's theater with an R-E, theaterworks.org for more information. My guest has been Robert Kelly, director of this production and of many at Theater Works that we'll look forward to talking about down the road. We heard a bit of the wonderful overture to start off with. What's another standout number for you that you'd like us to share?
I think Children of the Wind is my favorite. It's sort of a defining statement of the immigrant experience, and in this case, specifically the Jewish immigrant experience coming to the United States.
Okay, what's another one? I didn't see that listed in my particular soundtrack list here. Unfortunately, I'm just picking off of YouTube here.
A Brand New World is a great tune also, which is the experience of an immigrant from Russia, from a shtetl in Russia, opening her eyes onto the streets of New York for the very first time.
And Children of the Wind is a nice tune from that.
Yes, it's just beautiful.
Let's hear that.
I love Children of the Wind.
It's from the original soundtrack from Broadway and Rags, Children of the Wind. Robert, thanks so much for coming in today.
Great pleasure, David. Thank you.
What's that music playing down there in the street? On that pushcart, is that a thing you could eat? That one, why is he yelling so loud at the fat one? What a crowd they got. Who's that lady? What has she got on her head? No more hats here. It's feathers and fruit instead. So many noises, colors mixed up and swirled into a brand new world here. Here we are in a brand new world. Hush, now hush, my Duvedel. See, there's nothing wrong now. Through so much we've come so far, acting braver than and our sweet old. There's that music, listen, it's playing so nice. See that wagon, all full of nothing but ice. Look there, see the clothing so fine, like a book there. Ah, there's a Chinaman, see that lady. Where did she find all those eggs? Look at that one, no, don't you could see her legs? That ain't no town there, down there, tumbled and twirled. No, that's a brand new world here. Look at us in a brand new.
From Rags, Brand New World, a book by Joseph Stein, music by the great Charles Strauss, and the wonderful Stephen Schwartz wrote the lyrics. At TheaterWorks Silicon Valley through the 30th of this month, Mountain View Center for the Performing Arts, TheaterWorks, theaterworks.org for more information. Well, while we're on the Broadway musical front, a new show has been making its rounds in various venues here in San Francisco. It's The Last 5 Years by Jason Robert Brown, an off-Broadway cult classic about a five-year relationship between Jamie, a Jewish writer, and his girlfriend Kathy, an Irish Catholic actress set in New York City. Performing the roles of Kathy and Jamie are Courtney Merrill and Misha Stevens, who joins me in studio. Both actors are in San Francisco, and they met at the Ray of Light Theater back in 2015, playing opposite each other in a premiere new production by Tony-winning writers Greg Kottis and Mark Hallman, writers of the musical Year in Town. Courtney most recently played Janet in last year's Ray of Light production of Rocky Horror Show at the Victoria Theater, and Misha has most recently played Freddie in the ABBA rock show Chess. Misha, welcome to Open Air. Let me get your mic on here, and there you are. Hello.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Sure. You have a wonderful musical director who couldn't be with us today by the name of Brett Strader. He's a phenomenal talent, and tell us what he's brought to your production.
Yeah, he's just been incredible. He was a real great find for us. He's played the show a number of times in the past. He's very familiar with not only the subject matter, but also the intricacies of the musicality of it. It's an incredibly hard score to play from a piano, just technical standpoint. It's very jazzy, very sounding, very improvisational, but very fast-paced. And honestly, it's one of these scores that grabs you from the beginning, and every single song you hear, you want to kind of just take it home with you and listen to it again and again. And he has that familiarity with it, luckily, to bring an ease to playing it that just makes it seem effortless, as it should sound.
How did you first encounter the show?
You know, I actually only heard about it somewhat recently and pitched the idea to Piano Fight, which is where it's being performed downtown, and when I got the rights to it and I secured the space, I went to Courtney Merrill, approached her, and sort of pitched the idea to her and said, hey, would you want to do this show I heard about Last 5 Years? And she immediately reacted with, yes, of course. Nice. She's known about it since it first came out and has the score memorized, both parts memorized. So it has this cult classic status in the theater scene. And
the music is really appealing. That's why I asked you on, because it's such a great, refreshing sound that we're going to hear. Yeah. You've already had 6 performances at Piano Fight. Where are the remaining performances going to be?
We have a couple more remaining performances. We were sold out, and so Piano Fight was gracious enough to extend us a couple weekends. So we have 2 more performances they gave us on this coming Saturday, the 15th, and then Saturday, the 22nd.
Nice. Yeah. PianoFight.com for more information about those tickets and about the show. Yeah. So we're going to be treated to a live performance here. What are we going to hear?
Well, you know, the story is so interesting, the way it tells this love story from these 2 different timelines, where Kathy's really telling her story backwards, and her first song in the show is this punch to the gut where she's just been, or they've just broken up. She's just read sort of this heartbreaking letter, and she's reflecting on her past, and then the very next song, because Jamie's telling the story forwards from the first time they meet, so you have this incredible contrast, juxtaposition of Kathy, who's experienced this heartbreak, to then Jamie, who's seeing the love of his life for the very first time, who you've just heard sing her song. So that's sort of what we'll hear first.
Let's hear it. And this is from the last 5 years, a live performance by Misha.
Breaking my mother's heart. The longer I stand looking at you, the more I hear it splinter and crack from 90 miles away. I'm breaking my mother's heart. The JCC of Spring Valley is shaking and crumbling to the ground, and my grandfather's rolling, rolling in his grave. If you had a tattoo, that wouldn't matter. If you had a shaved head, that would be cool. If you came from Spain or Japan or the back of a van, just as long as you're not from Hebrew school, I'd say, now I'm getting somewhere. I'm finally breaking through. I'd say, hey, hey, chick's a goddess. I've been waiting for someone like you.
Misha Stevens in a live performance here at the KLW studios of an excerpt from the last 5 years, music by Jason Robert Brown. Very nicely done.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. The shows remaining, a couple shows are going to be at TheaterWorks this coming Saturday and the following. I'm sorry, at Piano Fight.
Wish.
PianoFight.com. You hear that, Robert Kelly? I think Misha's making a subliminal wish for PianoFight.com for the remaining performances. And when is the, I understand it's going to be back at Martuni's, which is where I saw part of it.
You know, we might do that if there's popular demand. So get your tickets for Piano Fight and make your request there.
Starring Misha Stevens and Courtney Merrill. Thanks again for coming in, Misha.
Thank you.
appropriate tune to introduce critic at large and regular contributor Peter Robinson to talk about the Summer of Love experience, Art, Fashion, and Rock and Roll, which just opened at the DeYoung Museum here in San Francisco. Welcome back, Peter.
Hi, David. Good to be here. Memories for me, because I actually first came to the city in the year after this, in 1968, and I still remember rolling over the Golden Gate Bridge. I'd come in from Oregon. I was teaching at Lewis and Clark up in Portland. And already the after effects of what I'm going to call the Summer of Love seem to be resonating in the streets. Now, this particular exposition, I think, really covers in many different ways all that went on in that particular year. So you've got iconic rock posters, you've got photographs, you've got interactive music, and of course you've got light shows. And then in a totally different area is the costumes, the textiles, because the whole fashion industry took a different turn. And of course there's ephemera, and they do screen some of the avant-garde and type of films that came with the counterculture that blossomed throughout that particular period. So I highly recommend a trip to the DeYoung Museum just to get you in touch with how we were in the city 50 years ago. And when I look about the history, when I think back, there were a lot of things which I actually needed to be reminded about that go back to that particular year. For example, the birth of the natural food industry. Suddenly people were revisiting exactly what we ate and the reasons that we were eating that. There was concern for the environment. Again, interesting, today we take environmental issues and the ecology as something that's all part of our everyday life. 1967, this sense of ecological soundness, environmental movements also took their birth. And of course, sexual liberation in every sense. People may remember the movie or the musical Hair, and again to see how that in its own way reflected on a change of the times. And with it comes the challenges to the nuclear family. Now, all this is put together in four or five different rooms at the DeYoung, and you become aware that this was an era of both political and social activism. And I see it really as a turning point in terms of the course of American history. The counterculture, just as the name suggests, offers alternatives to the mainstream. And ironically, we look today and it flourishes today. I smile when I think about customizing jeans, because we were living in the period of the bell bottoms. Today, you know, fashion industry is now taking us the other way around, and we actually have narrow trousers. I look at the bookshops, and this was a movement which really generated a different style and a different range of reading from Eastern spirituality, psychology, contemporary literature. And with them came the boutiques and the fashions all melded together. Now, one particular room, which is the poster room, has many of the visual works of Victor Moscoso, who was a Yale University student. He'd come to San Francisco, and he started very much playing around with different concepts of design. And that song we were hearing, the invasion of the flower children, you come to Santa Cruz, put flower in your ears, led to a movement which was called the Be-In, B-E-I-N. And Be-In meant gathering in Golden Gate Park, probably dropping a couple of tabs of acid just to get into the happy swing of things, because this indeed was the era of Timothy O'Leary. It's also Jerry Garcia, and you start mentioning bands from this period, and the names just range through from the Grateful Dead, of course the Beatles. Things were moving from North Beach, from the coffee house culture of the beatnik, to something different. And that something different included Jefferson Airplane, Grace Slick, and the big name, of course, Bill Graham, and that little troupe of mime dancers. But since the Beatles have begun to make the impact, they have a song which, of course, includes the word love. And I think love is the initial spirit of what we experienced in 1967. Here they
Close
go.
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you. Pretend that I'm missing the lips I am missing, and hope that my dreams will come true. And then while I'm away, I'll write home every day, and I'll send all my loving to you.
Now, I think one of the sad ironies, if we again look at it from a historian's point of view, is that beyond all my loving, beyond the spirit of the love-in and the be-in, came the tragedies of 1968. April the 4th, 1968, Dr. Martin Luther King is shot and killed in Memphis, Tennessee. And we're beginning to feel the alternative to what was really going on. June the 5th, 1968, 1 year after the Summer of Love, here in California itself, Senator Robert Kennedy, again, is shot, having just been won the California seat. So we're beginning to see this change coming. And perhaps the herald of that change was Walter Cronkite in his famous Vietnam commentary, which aired on CBS News in February of 68, where it became clear to him as the reporter on the ground that whatever else was going to happen, the war in Vietnam was not going to reach any type of definite or positive conclusion from the American standpoint. So you have the Summer of Love.
And that ended up with President Johnson's famous saying, if we lost Cronkite, we've lost the war.
We've lost the war, yeah. And, of course, Cronkite eventually will tender his resignation in a roundabout way. So it was a turning point. So I think we've got to contrast the 100,000 people who came in the Summer of Love to visit San Francisco, to experience the light shows, participate in the music, and be part of that whole very different movement, the turnaround, and at the same time look ahead to the future. And the future was very sobering and somewhat sad. And a couple of things I'd add to that. If you're interested in this period, a book I would highly recommend is called The Season of the Witch, and it's by David Talbot, who went on to found Salon magazine. And I think he too captures what he hoped was going to be a city of peace and love, to find out that the 60s and 70s were no longer the beacon of enlightenment, but the Zodiac Killer, the other upsets that came.
Kent State shootings in 1970.
Yeah. So you've got a really turning point. I think historians like turning points because you can see the before and you can see the after.
I can see the books being written about this era as well, given the current political climate. And again, the Summer of Love experience to see this, art, fashion, and rock and roll, just opened at the DeYoung, and it's running for some time. Go to deyoung.famsf.org for more information about that exhibit.
Now, this particular week has been a busy week for me because I've had visitors from London who want to experience the San Francisco experience, which is one good reason why this particular exhibit at the DeYoung was important. And these were journalists and actors. So we also went off to see Beach Blanket Babylon. And again, I can not say anything other than total praise for this very fun, loving show. Like many residents here, I've seen it a number of times, but it's also a timely show, so it captures the moments and it captures the era. and above all, it captures, I think, the zaniness of San Francisco. It celebrates the liberal spirit of the city. The story, in one sense, never changes. The story, of course, is about Snow White, and she's on a journey to meet her prince. The prince keeps on changing every year, and the parody and the satire, particularly of the Von Trump family.
Oh, no. I can see what's coming already.
It's really going to get you shaking and jumping in the aisles. So I thoroughly recommend for a total evening out of satire, of fun, of laughter, of music. And I think the remarkable thing is the speed that they have to change their costumes, because they all have these wonderfully extravagant hats. But then they have many costume changes in what I consider to be a very fast-moving, short-paced time. And if you've ever worked in the theatre, that type of time change in costume is really important. One thing I noticed, and a couple of my British friends mentioned this, there's the element of a panto. The pantomime in Great Britain is something that kids go to, the audience participate in, they shout back. And I think you'll get all of that alive and living at the new version, or the current version, that is, of Beach Blanket Babylon, which is a real exciting and fun night out. So I reflected. Here was a week which, for me, had actually begun at the Symphony with Marla. We had gone on to Beach Blanket Babylon. We'd gone to the Summer of Love. And then I finally took friends on a ferry to Angel Island. And I said to myself, we are living in a wonderful part of the country. And somebody said, would I write a piece about should California secede from the Union? I suddenly threw the flag high. I said, with an almighty, yes, indeed. So you've got many choices going this week. Check out the De Young. You'll enjoy the current memories of the summer of 1967. You'll certainly enjoy Beach Blanket Babylon. And of course, now that the sunshine is out and the rain has stopped, hop on a ferry and take a trip out to Angel Island. Which makes me think, that's really why I left my heart in only one place. And where is that place? Can we say it together? San Francisco!
Indeed. Thanks, Peter. Mm-hmm. Again, that Summer of Love experience is running through August 20th at the De Young. I'm David LaTulipe. You've been listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio. My thanks to my producer, Niels Swinkle. Our shows are archived at kalw.org. If you've got a show suggestion, by all means, send me an email, david@kalw.org. Thanks for listening.